People say to me, Rosie, why did you walk away? Why didn't you fight? Because I didn't want to fight. I didn't feel it was necessary. I beat death.
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today we're speaking with broadcaster, motivational speaker, and Paralympic gold medalist Paul Rosen about legacy, ethics, and Toronto's unreasonable love for the Leafs. Paul Rosen is a three-time Paralympian who played on Canada's gold medal-winning sledge hockey team in Torino, Italy in 2006. He's also the oldest rookie in the history of the sport, having joined the national team at age 41, so he's no stranger to taking on challenges later in life. He undertook his greatest challenge just last year, at the age of 51, when he enrolled in an adult literacy course. Our conversation ranges from his experiences in Paralympic competition to Lance Armstrong and performance-enhancing drugs. He also waxes philosophical about the shortage in our cultural economy of investments of sweat equity and the conscious creation of one's legacy. We start with a little bit of his history.
For me, as a 15-year-old, well, as a young adult, all I wanted to do, like any Canadian, was to be an NHL star. I didn't care. Grew up my whole life in Toronto, but was never really a Leaf fan. Sorry about that. I was a Chicago Blackhawk fan.
They're not giving you a lot of reason to be a Leaf fan right now.
Well, so. Nobody is with no hockey right at the moment. But at 6 years old, I went to my first game at the old Maple Leaf Gardens in 1966. I met Bobby Hall. I shook his hand, and his big, massive hand just devoured mine. And it made me love the game even more. At 15 years old, right winger, coming around the net in Barrie, Ontario at the Dunlop Arena, caught a rut in the ice, broke my leg in 14 places, and that was pretty well the end of my career, so everybody told me. Mm-hmm. But the one thing I think when you try to discourage a young person, whether it's a female or a male, is you can't take away their desire to achieve. You can try to put them down. But I always had that desire to achieve that was bigger than anything anybody could tell me. And years later, it worked out pretty good by playing 11 years for this great country, competing in three Paralympic Games, and ultimately winning a gold medal in Torino 2006 with my teammates. No team sport is won by an individual.
So what happened in between there? How did you go from leg broken in 14 places, discouraged certainly, to many years later? You're 15 years old when that injury took place, and you were how old when you won your gold medal?
46.
So what happened in those intervening 19 years, 24?
No,
20?
many.
My math
closer
is terrible.
30, yeah, my math is, I left school in grade 9, but you know what? I had some great, I had two very influential people in my life. One was my grandfather, and one was my father. And the two of them always gave me that little extra push, you know, when I was 17 in pain or when I left school. And there's a lot of things that happened to me over that journey. And I got married at 21. I had my first child at 22. And, you know, my kids are 28, 27, and 25. So those years, it was just always never giving up. And in 1997, I was involved with the Israeli national hockey team overseas in a tournament. That's when things really changed. I broke my leg again. They had to do a knee replacement. There was nothing left. The replacement got infected. And I'm very careful when I speak to older groups and I say that, because then, you know, they go, oh my God, I'm having a knee replacement. Mm-hmm. And what happened to me was one in a billion, not even one in a million, an infection as bad as it happened, to lose my leg, life or limb. I chose life over limb. But I truly believe that things happen for a reason. It was my time to shine. And the only way that I could shine and help others was to lose my leg. So I never felt bad. People ask me that all the time because I'm involved with a lot of different organizations, depression and suicide prevention and different things like that. You know, are you always this happy? No, I'm not always this happy. I have day-to-day issues. I have problems. But nothing has ever had to do with losing my leg. Mm-hmm. Like divorce and different things that have happened to me have happened to me because they're day-to-day events that everybody goes through. But it had nothing to do with my leg. I have never in 14 years, and you've known me a little bit, mm-hmm. I've never in 14 years felt sorry for myself because I'm missing my leg. It doesn't bother me whatsoever. Most people, when they see me, don't think I'm missing my leg if they don't know me. They just think I'm limping a little, you know, a little older, have a bad hip, bad back. But, you know, I couldn't care less. I woke up this morning, I took a shower, put my leg on. It's, you know, it's like most people, they put their boots on, they put their pants on, I put my leg on. Who cares? It's a big part of who I am today because of my journey, but it's got nothing to do with what I've accomplished. That's all in my heart and my head. And I really try to emphasize that, especially with kids. We have too many kids in this country that settle for mediocrity. They don't strive for greatness. And if we can teach them, you know, the easiest thing to do is tell somebody that they can achieve greatness, that they're a loser, they're a nothing, they have nothing to offer society. The toughest thing to do is put your arm around somebody and show them how to achieve greatness. Mm-hmm. And if you do that, it is the most rewarding thing you will ever achieve in your entire life. And when I talk to kids about that, they believe it because I've lived it. Mm-hmm. I'm not just, you know, shooting the breeze to them. I'm not just telling them a story, telling them to just move on and, yeah, you can do it. And I'm telling them because I've lived it every single day.
Mm-hmm. You've overcome real challenges and difficulties in your life, and you have a gold medal to throw in the face of those difficulties, those challenges, those people who would say, no, you can't.
Yeah, and the gold medal is the bonus. I try to make people understand that the gold medal is the bonus for me. Not everybody can win a gold medal. We have very few people in this country that have gold medals. The stats are incredible. I think there's only 30 or 35 athletes that have ever competed in more than three games. There's only 10, as far as maybe in London they might have added a little more, but there's only 10 that have competed in summer and winter, mm-hmm. 7 that have medaled in summer and winter, and 1 that's done it all after 40. Mm-hmm. That's all me. And I don't say that to make people think, whoa, hey, man, we got a superstar here now, because I am so far from a superstar. But I didn't give up. You know, at 39, I just felt like, hey, this is the next chapter. They've taken my leg. They haven't taken my desire or my soul. And everything I did from the age of 40 to 51, I did because I believed in myself. We have some incredible, incredible people in this country, not just athletes, but people that achieve great things every day. And nobody knows about it, and that drives me nuts. We have such a apologetic country here. You know, oh, I'm so sorry we achieved. Oh, I'm so sorry we're Canadian. Oh, that's, we got to stop that.
Yeah, I'm like, sorry I stood out from the crowd.
It's ridiculous. It drives me absolutely crazy. And you know, I think as a Torontonian, I think it's really important for our young leaders to really impress our politicians to. And I don't know, we wanted to get political here, but I think living in Toronto, it's an enormous opportunity to show the rest of this country how great Canadians are.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that, about the difficulties Canadians have in standing out in limited audiences for some of these tremendous accomplishments. In Vancouver, as recently as 2010, the Olympics drew enormous crowds, and the Paralympics, not so much. There were certainly crowds, there was a lot of attention, but not to the same degree. What do you think about that, and what do you think are the opportunities and the challenges?
Well, I look at things how they've progressed. So when I made the team in the year 2000, there was nobody. Nobody cared. We had to pay our own way.
Are you serious?
Yeah, we had to pay a fee to be on the Canadian team. I remember it cost us $2,000 a year to compete for Canada. And in Salt Lake City, our games are shown 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. I thought they'd get better for Italy. Our gold medal game, I'm sitting in front of you with the gold medal from Torino, Italy. It was a massive accomplishment. Bob Nicholson from Hockey Canada said it was the most exciting game he had ever seen. He's seen a lot of games, Bob Nicholson, CEO of Hockey Canada. And unfortunately, we won that gold medal on March the 17th, 2006. The game was aired at 2 o'clock in the morning, April the 19th, a month later. So Vancouver, in my mind, and the young guys on the team's mind, was night and day. Like, so many people, every one of our games were sold out, despite the fact, unfortunately, we didn't win the gold medal in Vancouver, which was kind of a heartache and a sore spot, even though it's been 2 years. It's still a sore spot when people bring it up. And it baffles me when people say to me, what happened in Vancouver? And I want to just knock them out cold, to be honest with you. Well, you know what happened. You watched the game.
We didn't win.
Yeah. Believe me, when we woke up the morning of that game against Japan, the last thing on our mind was losing to the Japanese. The last thing. And for those of you that have watched the game of sledge hockey, you know that I was a very aggressive, some people would say dirty, I would say aggressive goaltender. You've seen me play. You can't get mad at the Japanese. Like, a Japanese guy skates through my crease, I punch him in the side of the head, and he apologizes to me. How can you get mad at a kid like that? You can't. So by the time we realized what was happening in that game, we lost. And it was difficult, but where we were in 2010 to where we were in 2000 and 2002 is incredible. Is it where we need to be? No, not even close. Am I terrified that Sochi 214 will go back to Salt Lake City? Yes, I am. Because there's going to be a... First of all, for those of you that are listening that don't understand, the games in Sochi, Russia, and I got to be very careful how I word this because I'm going to be there broadcasting. Sochi, Russia is a beautiful place. Have you ever been there?
No, never. I'd love to, though.
Beautiful place. St. Petersburg, gorgeous. Moscow, gorgeous. Women there, baby, just absolutely beautiful. Beautiful Russian women. But Sochi, Russia is kind of like Orangeville to Ontario.
Yeah, it's like Banff to Calgary or Edmonton, right? It's like...
Well, Banff is gorgeous. Sochi's really not. Unfortunately, not.
Oh, I see. Oh,
I'm talking about, you know, size.
I thought
size.
You meant distance from the center.
No.
Size as well.
Sochi,
like,
is, yeah, it's going to be, in my opinion, it's going to be tough for them to put on the games that they're going to have to put on to compete with what London did, which was insanity, and what Vancouver did, which was incredible. Because Sochi just doesn't, in my mind, fit. Now, I hope I'm surprised. I hope when we get there, I'm like, whoa, the Russians really put on a great job. I think they would have been better off being in St. Petersburg, a place like that. But we'll see what happens. The problem is the Paralympic Games haven't even been picked up yet, believe it or not.
By a broadcaster, you mean?
Yeah. CBC is doing the Olympics, the Olympic Games, the TSN and the consortium, Bell Media, all of that. It stopped after
London.
So CBC put in an insane bid to get back. And I hope they do a great job. I'm going back on what they did in Torino and what TSN and that whole group did in Vancouver and Beijing and London, which you can't even compare what they did. And it's not fair to compare because they have so many more outlets and opportunities. But I feel... I'm very, very worried that the Paralympic Games, if they are picked up, which they better be, are going to be like they were in Torino, where you're going to see the broadcasting days or weeks or months later.
Yeah, wherever it fits into the schedule.
Yeah, it won't be. And whether they send reporters over to do live broadcasts, because our gold medal game, I didn't know this because I'm worried about playing, but Rick Middleton and Rob Snook, they actually broadcasted the games on a delay from Toronto.
Through streaming or something.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Which, certain sports, I guess you could do it. You know, maybe curling, no disrespect to curling. but
curling gets huge crowds and massive attention, enthusiasm.
As well it should, But hockey, you have to be there. Like, I've been fortunate to be the color guy for a few games, and I have another one coming up, the World Cup. But you have to be there to see the little angles, what's going on behind the scenes. The one thing I love about doing color, and I think that's why goaltenders make the best color commentators, because we're behind the scene watching everything, is as the play-by-play is doing, the play-by-play gentleman is doing, or lady is doing the play-by-play, the color guy sometimes is watching what's happening behind the play that the camera's not getting. When you're watching it on a monitor in another country, how can you pick that up? And then if you can't pick that up, how can you put forth that to the fan who's watching, especially the Paralympics, to the disabled fan? How many visually impaired people are listening to the game? And they're trying, you know, your voice is their eyes.
Interesting. You're absolutely right. And when the color commentator or the play-by-play can't see what's going on behind, they can't comment on reffing issues or disputes or anything else.
Nothing at all. They can't see what's going on in the crowd. They can't see what the coach is saying to a player. The thing that I pride myself on is getting the point of view across to the fans from a player. You know, so the player comes off the bench, off the ice, onto the bench. He's had a bad shift. I'm watching his interaction with the coach, and then I'm telling the fan, who maybe doesn't know everything about that player, what's happening. Well, you better watch this next shift, Billy Bridges. I think he's going to be very angry with what just happened on the bench. Watch what he does. Little things like that. That's why I love baseball. To me, is the ultimate sport to listen to on the radio, if you have a great broadcaster. And Dan Schulman, a Toronto boy, I love ESPN, one of the best, if not the best. I love watching ball, turning the volume down on the TV and listening to him on the radio, because he's one of the few guys that can take you to that stadium when you're not even anywhere near that stadium.
And just describe the whole picture in his words.
Yeah. Driving in a car, listening to a World Series game with Dan Schulman, I actually feel, and I think this is the ultimate respect to any broadcaster, I actually feel like I'm in the seats.
I'm going to take you in a different direction now, because I see you wearing a yellow Lance Armstrong bracelet. So I have some questions for you about not only Lance Armstrong, but about performance enhancement in general. So let's start. Lance Armstrong. Go.
He's a hero to me. I do an internet show Friday nights, and it's funny that the last show we did 2 weeks ago, somebody called in and said, you know, I think you're the only one, other than maybe his wife and immediate family, and I've never met Lance, that still backs him. And I'm going to give you some reasons why I back Lance. Number one, I was drug tested over 20 times. Never tested positive. Never gave anybody a reason to. I was always tested because I was an older athlete who was very fortunate to play at a high level. I played at a high level because I worked my butt off to be as prepared as possible. Lance never tested positive. This drives me crazy that we live, people say, America, America, the beautiful America, you're innocent until proven guilty. You're not. Lance Armstrong has been vilified. I'm wearing a Livestrong bracelet. There is thousands and thousands and thousands of cancer survivors in this country, in the world, that have benefit from Lance Armstrong's...
From the Livestrong Foundation?
From Livestrong and from Lance Armstrong's passion for helping people. This is a guy who's done so much, and he's never been... Until Lance Armstrong comes out and says, I did it, or he's tested positive, I will never, ever leave his corner. For me, having hearsay or a teammate, could be jealousy, could be anything, say, yeah, I injected Lance. Well, why can't a teammate come out now? I have a lot of good things going for me, and say, in 2005, I gave Rosie an injection in the washroom in Nagano, Japan. Oh, no, nobody was there, and we had a whole bunch of different things that nobody would ever. What is that? Like, that's gutless to me. Come out and give me some proof. Don't just say that you injected Lance in the bum or whatever. Just show me something. Show me a needle. Show me something with DNA. Show me. I'm waiting to see some proof, not just garbage proof, some proof that he is dirty. And until then, I don't believe it. And the thing, you're destroying his life now. Mm-hmm. His legacy, to me, legacy is so important. You know, I had, we'll get into what I do with suicide prevention in a bit, I'm sure. And I'll tell you that story. But I think legacy is critical. And you've destroyed his legacy for his children, his grandchildren, anybody that has survived cancer. Why? Because you didn't like what he did? Mm-hmm. It drives me absolutely crazy. And I will go to my grave being a supporter and thinking Lance Armstrong is a hero. I do not support performing enhancing drugs. I do not support cheaters. But in my mind, Lance Armstrong isn't. Until I know for sure, he is. I'm not going to do that. Do we hang a guy on hearsay? Do we put somebody in jail? Well, in the States, I guess anything's possible. You know, in not in the greatest way, and that's why I am so proud to be Canadian, because I don't think that could happen in this country.
Though his opinion is certainly tarnished here north of the border as well, and one of his teammates who hails from here in Canada even spoke against him. He said that Michael Berry, cyclist, he said that he had never seen Paul take anything or use anything, but that the team was so rife with it that he couldn't imagine it not to be true.
Okay, well, Lance, just to correct you, not Paul, Lance.
Did I call you?
Yeah, you can call me Lance Armstrong any day of the week, my friend. But you know what? Even making a comment like that, that's like me saying, well, you know, we live with 10 people in my house and there was stuff everywhere. So I can't see Mike not, taking something. Well, no. Hold on a second. There was everything in the house. Every room had it. But I never saw Lance do it. I never saw Mike do it. I never saw Paul do it. So I can't say that it's true. You know, it was all there. I just got to let everybody know it was all there. But I have no clue. Mm-hmm. So why are we speculating? Why are we even telling anybody? Why can't we just let this guy live his life? Why can't we just let him, you know, they've taken his Tour de France away. Now they're coming after him for $4.5 million in prize money. And they want to take his medal away from the Olympics in Sydney. And then people say to me, well, if you're so, if you believe Lance so much, why isn't he fighting? He doesn't want to fight anymore. Have you ever survived cancer? You know, I never had cancer. I had an infection that almost killed me. But I was in the hospital for months and months and months and months. I had 31 surgeries, Mike. I was put to sleep many times. It comes to a point where I just said, forget it. Like, you know, I was in a vicious divorce. You know that. I walked away. People say to me, Rosie, why did you walk away? Why didn't you fight? Because I didn't want to fight. I didn't feel it was necessary. I beat death. You know, when death, fortunately, you don't know what that's like, and I hope you never know what it's like. But when death is knocking on the door and it says, I'm coming, and then you open another door and let it go through, you don't want to be involved in petty garbage. So that's what I feel. I've never met Lance. I would love to sit down and talk to him because I'm a huge supporter and I always will be. But I truly believe that's what Lance is saying. You know what? I'm not doing this anymore. I told you that I wasn't. I told you that I didn't. I'm working to save people's lives and raise money that has never been raised and never will be raised again. And if you don't believe me, that's your problem, not mine. And I'm not going to put up with it anymore.
Yeah, he's fought for long enough, is what you're saying?
It's enough.
Yeah.
He beat death. What else does he have to do?
Mm-hmm. So on the subject of performance enhancement, you say that you were tested 20 times over your Paralympic career, and that would have been between volleyball and hockey. Is that correct?
Very good. Yes, mm-hmm. Volleyball too.
I did my homework.
Thank you.
So how common is the use of performance-enhancing banned substances within the Paralympic realm in your experience or in your understanding?
I have never met anybody who has taken told me they've taken. I've never seen anybody take. If I did, I would definitely go to somebody. I wouldn't go to the press. I wouldn't destroy them, but I would go to the proper NSO, the proper sports
Center
authority.
Center for Ethics and yep. Sport.
I would go to CCES. I would do something because I don't feel it's right for me to compete side by side with somebody who is not working as hard as he can. And for me to play at the level I played at the age I played at, I had to work extremely, extremely hard to stay beside an 18, 19-year-old.
I'll bet.
You know, at the age of 40, whatever. But, you know, I don't believe in it, and I've never seen it. No player. First of all, when a player makes your team and you're a team, what people don't understand is if you see the gold medal I'm holding in my hand, if we would have had somebody on that team test positive, I wouldn't be holding this. Mm-hmm. It's not an individual sport. You lose everything as a team. So one guy in the team does something, we lose, tarnish the reputation of a great country like Canada, and everybody loses their gold medal. So we have a little thing where the veterans take the rookie in his first games and, you know, very, very calmly explain to them the fact that if you decide to take a performance-enhancing drug and get caught, the last thing you're going to have to worry about is losing the gold medal. We'll leave it at
14
that.
14 other guys, yeah.
We'll leave it at that. Your life will not be worth anything. So there's a respect factor in team sport that I think is very, very high.
Mm-hmm. In September, the medical and scientific director of the International Paralympic Committee, this is Peter van de Vliet, just in anticipation of the London Paralympics, said that as the Paralympics become more popular globally and commercial interests increase, as we saw over the course of those games, the incentive to cheat would grow. What do you think of that? Do you think that it's likely that the Paralympics will experience the same challenges the Olympics have?
I think it has to. It's human nature. There's so many people in life that want to, and this is why I talk to kids. I do, 25, 30, 40 events a year with kids because I think they see that instant gratification, that, that $1 million. We have so many shows on TV, Amazing Race and American Idol and Canadian. Come on, man. Can't we just do something and achieve greatness without having the whole world watch these contests? And there's people that want to, my dad taught me a long time ago, he's 83 years old, and he taught me that hard work, there's nothing that beats hard work. And a lot of the people in this world, they want that prize. They want that $1 million. They want that gold medal. They want the pie in the sky, but they don't want to work for it. Well, that's garbage. That's not life. That's not the way it is. But unfortunately, in this reality world we live in, it is. So I truly believe that we will probably have a big name Paralympian. I think it'll be in an individual sport. I hate to say that. It'll be a swimmer or a runner, probably a runner that will test positive. In Rio 2016. I don't think it's going to be a winter athlete. I think it's most winter sports are team sports. Could be a skier, but I think running is. So we may have another Ben Johnson on our hands. I don't know. I hope not. I really hope not. But I think with this instant gratification world we live in, that somebody will look at the, oh my God, gold medal, and then somebody will say, well, I can get you that gold medal a lot faster. Just take this. They'll never find out. And the way that they're testing now, WADA, the World Anti-Doping Association, and CCS in Canada, it's very difficult to get around it, especially now with blood testing. When I was an athlete, it was just urine testing. Now there's blood testing. And you can't, once you say I'm not going to, that's a positive. Mm-hmm. You're done. You can't say no.
So you're saying that within a team sport, because there is that team apparatus that helps not only support the individual in their performance, but also to help stand as their moral compass, shall we say, it's less likely. What do you think that says about our culture, this individualism, these big $1 million TV prizes that are just anybody's for the taking is the myth behind them. Of course, it's a myth. What do you think that says about us here in Canada and North America about achieving greatness and the ways we go about it?
Well, I think it's sad. And I think it's not Canada or North America, it's the world. And I think it just shows you how greedy this world has become and how everybody wants that prize without working for the prize. That's never happened when we were kids or when our parents were growing up. You achieved something because you worked hard. And a lot of people nowadays achieve from means of deceit and greed.
That's a very cynical perspective you have.
I think it's a realistic perspective. But thank you. I appreciate that.
Today on The Public, we're speaking with Paul Rosen, the broadcaster, Paralympic gold medalist, and motivational speaker. In this half of the interview, he speaks about Leaf Nation, his work with groups helping adults improve their literacy, and the motivation and fulfillment he finds in contemplating legacy. The entire interview is available for streaming at CIUT.fm or at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca.
The Toronto Marlies, who play in the American Hockey League on a level one down from the NHL, have seen a huge surge in attendance during the lockout of the NHL this year. But if the last lockout stands as an example, numbers for them are going to go right back down as soon as the NHL is back on TV. What do you think about this, about one league getting the lion's share, even with other great sport? The Marlies are great hockey. What do you think about that split in audience?
Well, it's human nature. I think overall, in different markets, you will never compete outside of the NHL. Toronto people say is a sports city. I don't believe it's a sports city. I believe it's a Toronto Maple Leaf city. It's proven when the Leafs stink year after year after year, and the place is sold out continuously. And if the NHL lockout continues and there's no hockey this year, people say on sport TV, sport radio all the time, I'm not coming back. That's garbage. In Toronto, you're coming back. That first game next year after no hockey all year, there will be 20,000, I guarantee you. And there will be every year, every game, because the guy who decides he doesn't want to come back, there'll be 20 people want his tickets. Now, in Columbus, in Florida, in Phoenix, in Chicago, in San Jose, maybe even L.A., even though they won the Stanley Cup, yeah, they're going to have serious problems. The American Hockey League is great hockey. The unfortunate thing is in certain cities, it's a niche market in certain cities. You know, I've been to games in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, where they're the farm club of the Pittsburgh Penguins, 9,000-10,000 a game. In Toronto, they're getting 3,500, 4,000. As soon as the Leafs come back, they're back to 1,800 people. That's mm-hmm. just, it's reality. It's never going to change. The Marlies have some great players. We have the same problem with the OHL in this area. The Brampton Battalion are leaving. Excellent organization. They're going to go to North Bay because you can't, it's not a market. It's not a hockey market. People think it's a hockey market, Toronto. I'm telling you right now, Toronto's not a hockey market. It's a Toronto Maple Leaf market. So, it's sad. It's unfortunate for these guys that play at the highest level that you can possibly play at, other than the NHL. But it's realistic. It's not going to change no matter what they do.
Do you think that's a reflection of our culture and getting back to that to the contest atmosphere that we have? I mean, we have these contests on TV where one person wins $5 million in global fame and the number two person gets nothing and gets promptly forgotten. Do you think it's a similar situation when it comes to number one hockey versus number two hockey here in Toronto, at least?
I think it's got a lot to do with that. It is unfortunate because for those of us that love hockey, the Toronto Marlies were in the Calder Cup final. They lost to an incredible team that went on a roll of 29 wins in a row. Other than that, they were the second team in a 30-team league that is incredible, unbelievable hockey. And, you know, now they've got some great players because they've got a lot of Leafs that have come down with no hockey now. As soon as the Leafs come back, whenever it is, these 5-6 guys, the Jake Gardners, and they're going to be moved up to the big club because ultimately, the American Hockey League is a feeder system, and you want to there's two types of players that play in the American Hockey League. There's a player that's drafted that's going to be the great NHL star that has to get his feet wet at the American Hockey League level, and then as soon as he does, he's moving up. And then there's the aging star that doesn't want to give up but isn't good enough for the NHL anymore. So he goes down and he works as a mentor to the young guys. So it's an incredible game. I would ask anybody to go out and watch an American Hockey League game. Look at Hamilton, the Bulldogs, the Montreal Canadiens Farm Club. They're a great team. They're playing in a okay building, Cops Coliseum. They don't get more than 2,500, 3,000 fans in a 17,000-seat building. It's sad, you know. I've been fortunate. I played in front of 10, 12, 15,000 people. It's unbelievable.
I'll bet.
But when you play in a building that holds 15,000 and there's 2,000 people there, that's not fun.
It's pretty quiet.
Yeah. I remember one game we played in Lillehammer. It was close to the public, so it wasn't the Norwegians follow sleds like it would have been jammed. But it was a 15,000-seat building that they played the Olympics in 94 in Lillehammer. There was nobody in the building whatsoever. So it was just the Norwegians, us, and the referees. And I was screaming just to scream, to hear my scream come back at me, because it was such an incredible looking, wow, there's there's 15,000 empty seats, and it was different. It wasn't great, but it was different.
How do you get excited in an atmosphere like that?
Well, the only way that you can get excited is to know that you're beating the Norwegians, and if you play goal for a sledge hockey team in Canada, beating the Norwegians is the ultimate.
That's the dream?
That's the ultimate. Every time you beat them, doesn't matter whether it's on the road or... I've always said to people, and people that know my background, I've had some run-ins with... let's put it this way. I will not be invited to Norway anytime soon for Christmas. It's never going to happen. But I would take the Norwegians on in this room right now. You know, you get Rolf Pedersen and some of the boys want to come in right now, and we'll go. We'll go.
So you're not playing hockey right now anymore. Are you retired from sledge?
I have.
So does that mean you're going to go back to working in a funeral home then?
No.
No?
My days of picking up dead bodies are over. I was the Grim Reaper goalie. Stopped pucks by day, picked up bodies by night. That's done. I've got too many things to do and accomplish. I'm an ambassador for ABC Life Literacy. One of the few things I regret in my life is it's ironic that we're here at UFT, one of the greatest facilities in the world, educational facilities, that I left school in grade 9 back in 1976. And I ended up going back to school at 50 years old 2 years ago, got my grade 12 diploma.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I did a... People say, well, how'd you do it? If you ever watched the movie Billy Madison?
Mm-hmm.
I did the Billy Madison without the pretty teacher. it was pretty cool. I sent the diploma to my mom because it was the one thing that she was always, you know, really upset about, one of her children leaving school in grade 9. And it was important for me, and I'm an ambassador with them, going across the country, talking to adults, the vital importance of literacy. I couldn't read or write until I was... probably close to 50. There was no way I'd take that paper and try to read it 2 years ago. Not a chance. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's really important to teach people that. I'm an ambassador for StopConcussions.com, and I had 9 concussions over my career, as you know. There's many days where I honestly am lost. I have no clue what's going on, especially when I wake up in the morning. That's a fear for me. I have a 2-year-old grandson, and I'm fearful that in 10 years I don't know what's going to happen or whether I'll know who he is. And I think that's one of the big things I'm doing with the Legacy Foundation, trying to teach athletes right now the importance of taking care of their health. I'm very proud to say that I became the first disabled athlete to have his brain accepted to set medical science. My brain will be leaving me when I leave this earth to Boston University to be a part of the study that Probert and all the NHLers. Because, you know, the one thing that people don't understand about being disabled is we get injured just like you do. We eat just like you do. We are consumers just like you do. And what our mayor in this city, which I didn't want to get into, but I will, Rob Ford, doesn't understand is that we vote. And when you piss off somebody who's disabled, you just might have lost his vote. Like you lost mine, Mr. Ford, but that's another story. Well, maybe we'll have a political talk one of these days about my feelings about Mr. Rob Ford.
Before we go there, we could talk about Israel and the Gaza Strip as well if you really want to get your sleeve, roll your sleeves up. But before we go there, let's talk about your work with these literacy organizations. I know you've worked with more than one. And about, first of all, your decision after 40-some years struggling with literacy to finally to sit yourself down in front of a book with a teacher and learn.
I have to give all the credit to my oldest daughter, Stephanie. When she was a young child, I was a punk when we had her. And I do a lot of voices, as you know. We've traveled around this country at some events. So I would make fun. I would bring out my different voices, and I would make her laugh. And she'd forget about that book that was in front of us that I would never read. And as she got older, she's like, Dad, why don't you read me a book? And Dad, why aren't you reading the words? I'd have these great imagination stories where, you know, all three of my kids would be in bed and they'd say, okay, Dad, tell us a story. And I would say, okay, there was a little dog, and I'd start this story and it'd get bigger and bigger and different voices would come in and I'd have all kinds of different things and I'd have them mesmerized. And then I'd go back in my room and go, oh, fooled them again. Wow. Hmm. But I knew eventually, you know, smart kids, eventually they're going to say, well, how come you never read to us, Dad? And I had to tell them, because I can't read. And it was an eye-opening experience when Stephanie, after Torino, said to me, you know, I want you to be able to read to my child when I have a child. And I told her, I promised her that I would. And then when Vancouver ended and she got pregnant, I said, okay, this is it. I have to do it. Now, I got to tell you, one of the most difficult things ever is when I had to go in to be assessed at Grade Learning. I was sitting in a room just like this, very small, with one teacher and just me and the teacher. That was it. And there was nobody else there. And she hands me this piece of paper and says, okay, Paul, we have to assess you. Can you read it? I started sweating like I was, 200-pound kid on a hot August day eating an ice cream. It was scary. And I played in front of 12,000 hostile fans screaming and yelling and wanting to kill me because, you know, I wasn't the nicest guy. I remember my mom and dad in Salt Lake City and my mom saying, why do all the Americans want to kill you, Paul? Like, why are you? And I said, well, you really never saw the last game and what I never went to medical school, but have you ever seen sledge hockey? I could perform a spleenectomy very easily with the end of my stick. And you know what? It was nerve-wracking, but she did something that changed my life. The teacher in that room, and she said to me, don't worry about it. Just read. Just me and you. I don't care. And she gave me confidence. And that was the most important thing that I needed, because in grade 8 and grade 7 and grade 9, I had no confidence because the teacher said, you know, I remember an incident in grade 7 where we were reading Romeo and Juliet. And this teacher said, hey, Paul, why don't you read it? This should be fun. And I started, doing the, she goes, what are you, an idiot? And I remember saying, oh, my God, do I knock her out cold? And then it's going to be really bad because, I'm 15 and a fairly strong kid, and you knock a female teacher out. It's not that good. So I quit school. And I allowed somebody to destroy me emotionally and psychologically. And I said I would never allow that again. And I truly believe I'm a smart kid. Maybe I'm not book smarts. Maybe I can't go in into a class right now and sit down with all the other students and follow along with them. But I guarantee you right now, if they set up an event tonight for 5,000 people and I went in and spoke to them, I'd have all 5,000 of them walking out thinking, wow, that was incredible. Because it's all confidence. And I've learned how to grab that confidence and bring it out of myself and bring it out of other people. And thank God in 2012, teachers do not teach the way they taught in the 70s. Mm-hmm.
So you've worked with two literacy organizations. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and how you've been spreading this message?
Well, it's now ABC Life Literacy, and that's my main focus with them. And I just go across Canada, really, to teach the adult learners. I was just in Nova Scotia a little while ago, a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to a group of 30 adult learners that were just struggling with confidence and really told them my story. And that's all you really want, is you want to see somebody who's achieved and you feel the same as them. And then when they leave, you go, well, hey, why can't I achieve the same? And it's not about, see, my message, a lot of people think, is a hockey message. It's got nothing to do with hockey. I've achieved some incredible things from hockey. But, a couple of the things that mean the most to me, a gold medal is unbelievable, don't get me wrong. But I achieved something that means so much to me that in 2010, I received the Rick Hansen Humanitarian Award. There's only six Canadians that ever won it. The list of those Canadians are Mulrooney, Lieutenant David Onley, the Honorable David Onley, some big people. And then there's, 52-year-old Paul Rosen with one leg, left school in grade 9. Man, how does that happen? What happens because I believe my message is important, and it's not a hockey message. So, in 2009, I spoke at the University of Indiana, the Hoosiers, huge. I got an honorary degree. I remember when they talked to me about it and gave me the opportunity to choose my my degree. I'm thinking, wow, let's think about it. Lawyer or doctor? I had to be lawyer or doctor with my Jewish background. I wanted to make my parents proud. So I ended up going with a doctor because now my mom can think, hey man, my son's a doctor. Mm-hmm. I will not perform surgery. That will not happen. But things like that give me the opportunity to teach somebody out there that's going through a tough time right now and is ready to give up. And life's too incredible to give up.
So let's talk about that then. I know you're working with some suicide prevention organizations as well. Can you tell us about that message and the organization you're working with and the message you bring?
Sure. We're just in the midst of putting things together. So the organization is called A Million Reasons to Live. I can't really give you more on that right now, but maybe as we get into it, we'll come back and talk about that. It all goes back to a situation for me where my daughter, my oldest daughter, again, she attempted suicide 3 times as a teenager. And there's nothing harder on a parent than to go through that. And then I think the life-changing experience for me that made me realize why these professional athletes and why big-name athletes are committing suicide happened to me. I very rarely tell this story, but I'm going to tell it now because I'm in the midst of writing my life story and it will be in the book. I want you to imagine this, and this goes back to guys like Bogart with the Minnesota Wild who committed suicide, and Junior Seau, phenomenal football player, committed suicide. So we just win the World Championships. It's 2008, and I got this beautiful ring, 50 diamonds on it. Everybody thinks I'm a hero. Everybody thinks I'm a hero, that I'm, Jesus. Like it's insane. Kids in the disabled community are looking at me like, oh my God, you're my hero. And now I get back to my hotel room, Mike, and I turn the TV on. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. We just won the World Championships. I was the MVP. I'm like, I'm the man, man. I'm the man. Guys are out drinking, having fun. I think about my life. I don't think about winning the gold medal. I don't think about the MVP. I think about the divorce. I think about the pain. I think about one of my daughters who doesn't talk to me because she's disgusted that the rest of the world is my family. And then I turn the TV on and there's an interview with me. And I'm looking at this interview with me, and this interviewer is making me think that I'm incredible. But I know I'm not incredible. I know I'm just a regular guy. And I got a bottle of Jack Daniels beside me and a bottle of Percodan. And I said, down half the bottle. Take 6, 7, 10. I don't even remember how many. They were like Skittles to me. And go to sleep. Why did I wake up the next morning? Bogart didn't. Did the exact same thing. He had a bottle and pills. Why did I wake up the next morning? And when I woke up the next morning, I said to myself, I woke up to help people. You can slice it in any way you want, but I woke up to help people. Why did I not die? Easily could have died with what I took that night. So to me, I think suicide prevention, the biggest thing that you can do, and I'm not a doctor, but I truly believe that concussions lead to depression. Depression lead to addiction, addiction leads to suicide. I was addicted to pain medication and other drugs for 20 years. I can tell you right now, I'm extremely drug clean, drug free. I think the word legacy is the most important word to somebody going through troubled times. If we can get them, that junior sale, especially athletes, but the young kid who thinks that they have nothing to live for, and teach them the legacy. When you kill yourself, you take away your pain, but you bring on so much pain to so many people that loved you. And I truly believe that if we teach people about that word legacy and get them out of their pain and teach them that life is great, because life is great. On every level, life is great. I don't care. First of all, people say disability. I don't believe in the word disability because everybody's disabled. You're disabled. You just don't know what your disability is yet.
Oh, but, yes, I do.
Okay, well, there you go. Excellent. But, you know, everybody in this room is. And if you search hard enough, you will find your disability. It's up to you to let that disability control your life. I try to find the ability in my life every day. Nobody has to tell me I'm missing my leg. I know I'm missing my leg. I woke up this morning. I took a shower. I almost slipped and went flying because, you know, I only have one leg. But that's not a disability to me. That's just an inconvenience. I have to shower with one leg. You shower with two legs. It's how you look at life. And I think the suicide prevention, what I'm doing with A Million Reasons to Live, is so critical because we had 1 million people in the world commit suicide last year. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't.
Yeah, 1 million people. And if we don't, as society, take care of this, it'll be more and more and more and more. Because it's tough being a kid nowadays. And whether people believe it or not, just because you're an athlete, just because you have money, just because you're a role model, doesn't mean that you don't have problems.
Means the benchmark or the standard for your behavior is that much higher.
Well, yeah. And it drives me nuts when high-profiled athletes say, I don't want to be a role model. Hello? You took that $15 million check. You're a role model. You have to be a role model. There's kids that look up to you. Use your brains before you do something stupid. You know, you're an athlete and you want to, you know, I'm single. So I want to go out and have fun. You know, I can do it. I've got to think about it. But you're a married athlete and you're caught with a prostitute. That baffles me. It just, because you know that there's kids out there that are looking up to you, you know, abuse your wife, you know. It's stupidity. It really is stupidity. And again, it's legacy. You know, we've got great athletes who are not great human beings. And just because you're a great athlete doesn't mean you're going to be a great human being. And I think role models, your parents are your ultimate role models, and they teach you to be good people. And then good people become good athletes. And then the good athlete thing is one part of your character as a good person.
And by accepting a role in the spotlight, you also accept responsibility?
Absolutely. Like, I'm very proud that I'm a good person. If I die tomorrow, I can go to the next world knowing I never screwed anybody. I never stabbed anybody in the back. I never stole from anybody. There's things that I did in the realm of sport that, you know, Don Cherry might be happy, but, you know, somebody else might not be. But that's sport. I think the ultimate test and the ultimate sign of approval is when you leave this world. How do you leave the world? What legacy do you leave? And I know I leave a good legacy.
Do you think the distinction then between yourself and what you've accomplished and some, if not many, other people is that consciousness, that purpose in establishing your legacy as opposed to just thoughtless, you know, workaday existence?
I think so. I think you look at the people around you and you look, especially when you're in the public eye, I think you have to look at not just your family, but look at, and that's one of the things that can be a downfall to somebody in the public eye, because your kids suffer. My kids have. My youngest, you know, she's 25 right now, and we're just really getting a good relationship back. But for years, she couldn't stand me because she saw none of my kids like hockey because they saw hockey as the one thing that took me away from them. She saw an event where, 20 kids are all over me asking for autographs and thinking I'm something incredible. And she's thinking, well, you're my dad and I haven't seen you in ages. I missed 11 of her birthdays because her birthday always fell when we were at a tournament. So how do you justify that? It's difficult. It's something that I think athletes have to get help. Athletes are not immune from asking for help. I was very fortunate to have some incredible people help me psychologically over my bouts of depression and my bouts of loneliness while I was playing. To me, it's really about just taking an opportunity that you have. And my opportunity was excelling at an age where you're not supposed to. Achieving things at an age where you're not supposed to. Having the best success of my life in my 40s. You're not supposed to do that, especially in sport. So for me, it's so important to teach others that ultimately anything is possible, that if you believe that you can achieve greatness in life, you can. I'll never stop doing that. Anytime anybody ever needs my help, my website is www.paulrosen.ca. My email is info@paulrosen.ca. You can get a hold of me in so many different ways. And when it's helping somebody, whether they're sick, whether they need to realize that you can be a good person or a bad person, it's up to you. Nobody else is going to. Every morning I wake up, I look in the mirror, and I take credit for the good things I've done, and I take responsibility for the bad things I've done. If you live your life that way, I think you're going to live a great life.
We're going to close today's show with a song I hope you'll find appropriate. It's a cover of Albert King's Born Under a Bad Sign, as performed by brilliant Calgary singer-songwriter-guitarist Ellen McElwain. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through CIUT.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show for this week. We hope you'll tune in again.
If it wasn't for real bad luck, you know that I had no luck at all. the fantastic, the fabulous, and the famous Mr. Albert